know, I quote one of my Google scientist friends who was fond of saying that we humans are descendants of the nervous apes, that, you know, that the apes that were chill and calm, they all got killed. It's in all of our evolutionary biology, in our DNA as the human species, to be scanning for threats and to have a high level of looking for what can go wrong, being attuned to fear.
That was today's guest, Mark Lesser. Mark is an author and former CEO, co-founder and board member of the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. Search Inside Yourself is a leadership program developed with Google, utilizing the tools of mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and science. And in addition to Mark's role as CEO, or as former CEO, he's also a master teacher and leads trainings for executives through the US and internationally. In this show, we discuss Mark's new book on mindful leadership, the importance of human values in a rapidly digitizing world, and also the 7 lessons that you need to reap the benefits of mindful leadership in your own life. But before we start with the show today, I just want to quickly tell you about our upcoming Digital Wellness Festival in London on May 3rd and 4th. For the first time ever in the UK, this Digital Wellbeing Festival will be the place for all those people around the world who are committed to the future of digital wellbeing. The event brings together people and companies from around the world to explore current innovations in global digital wellbeing, the latest research and developments in this space, and also the companies building products with wellbeing in mind. Okay, let's get on with the show today. I hope you enjoy listening to Mark Lesser. Mark, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show with us today. It's actually been an ambition of mine for a long time to be able to converse with you and talk about this amazing body of work that you've collated over the years. So welcome to Digital Mindfulness.
Well, thank you. I'm already, you know, it's interesting. I think how much we tend to underestimate presence. And I don't know, I'm probably not the first person to say this to you, but I'll say it to you whether I'm the first or the 100th. You have really nice presence. There's something, your presence is very inviting and open. And so I'm really looking forward to this time together.
Thank you so much. So I wonder, for the audience that may not know much about your body of work, certainly I do, could you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself, and in particular, this fascinating journey of how you came to be focusing on Zen Buddhism, but also the intersection between that and leadership?
Yeah. Well, I often think, you know, there's the real answer is, who knows? Like, how did this happen? How did any of this happen? Like, But of course, we humans are really good at telling stories, and even if they're, it means kind of backing into explaining. So I have an explanation. I'll tell you how it looks. it started for me. You know, there's an expression. There's an expression in. I don't know where it comes from, but I think of it as a part of Zen practice, you know, and I should say, to me, you know, Zen practice is the study of what it means to be human and the study of consciousness and asking the question, how did we get here? And what do we do with this human life that we have? And I started asking those questions when I was in college and took a 1-year leave of absence and came from the East Coast to the West Coast in the States, and wandered into the San Francisco Zen Center, of all places, and it just completely captivated my attention and my imagination, and I ended up staying. That 1-year leave of absence turned into 10 years. So there was that, you know, that kind of that introduction to meditation and mindfulness and study. But a big surprise of all of that was the work aspect. And and that I kept being asked by the Zen Center community to take on different leadership roles, which completely surprised me. I just thought of myself as this, you know, kind of introverted, somewhat asleep, you know, guy from New Jersey. And I found myself, you know, 28 years old, running a kitchen that was part of a, you know, inside of a Zen monastery. But this Zen monastery, this place called Tassajara, turns into a resort and a conference center. So there were like really high standards for the quality of the food. And there are also high standards for work as practice. This was my first real taste and experience of work as a place of focus, connection with each other, of service, of kind of, you know, studying oneself and going beyond oneself. There was something I love. There was something just so much fun and satisfying and challenging about that work. And it kind of set the stage for me, or it set a kind of a bar about how I wanted to work in my life. And I thought, well, maybe this is what I'll do. Why isn't everyone doing this kind of using work as a place of growth? That was the beginning, and I ended up going from my 10th year of Zen Center right to New York University MBA program, and then I ended up starting a couple of businesses, and a few years later found myself teaching mindfulness at Google. So that's my story.
Now, this was a question I was going to ask at the end, but I think it's really pertinent now. And that is, just during the time that you have been working and really focusing on leadership in the workplace, I wonder if you can speak to the changes that have occurred during that time. What's actually different now in the workplace compared to when you started? And I guess this is a second question, but also that phrase that you mentioned earlier about workspaces being places for growth, not just professional growth, but emotional growth and human growth, whether workspaces can be considered that now, or again, if there's much more development and work to be done from that perspective.
I think if anything, you know, one can talk very pessimistically about the world of our workplaces, and this, you know, there's horrific statistics about you know, the level of disengagement in the workplace, and we see lots of headlines. You know, what we see in the headlines is doesn't paint a very encouraging picture about, you know, our workplaces. They appear to be driven primarily, you know, by greed, and that there's a lot of untruth and cover around that greed. So there is a lot of that. On the other hand, not making the news as much is, one of the things I'm fond of saying is that I call it the dirty little secret of the business world, is that it's all human beings. It's really all human beings. And we human beings are complicated, right? Greed, hate, and delusion have been very popular for thousands of years, and they seem to be no less popular today than ever. I also see people with incredible spirits and hearts and really wanting to find real solutions to some of these larger problems, but also wanting to create cultures of having the intention to create cultures of caring and connection and service and doing their best to do that.
So to that end, and adding to this amazing body of work that you have completed, you've just released this new book now, Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader. Can you talk about this book and in particular why it's so important?
I think it is about not underestimating the power of greed, hate, and delusion in that is embedded in the human beings. And I talk about, I quote one of my Google scientist friends who was fond of saying that we humans are descendants of the nervous apes, that, that the apes that were chill and calm, they all got killed. It's in all of our evolutionary biology, in our DNA as the human species, to be scanning for threats and to have a high level of looking for what can go wrong, being attuned to fear. And I think in some way we see that in all parts of our lives, even in the workplace. We see this inherent looking for what can go wrong, feeling separate from each other. So in a way, this book is in a way to be. I see the seven practices that I bring into write about in this book as antidotes to that, and as a way of shifting the playing field from one of fear, one of craving for that next thing, and for separation into a different, telling a different story about human beings and about how we can work together. And it's a story that of course it is aspirational and optimistic, but I also think that it's grounded and very, very practical. I keep coming back to that. I think in order for us to not only to thrive but to survive as a species, I think we're going to have to get better at these practices.
One of the things, Mark, that you mentioned earlier is that companies are comprised of people, and that people are inherently complicated. And put next to Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, the book itself is surprisingly short. Was this an attempt by you to reduce the complexity of the ideas of talking about people so that, I guess, readers could understand and get more clearly the points that you're trying to make?
Yeah, well, that's, practice number seven is the hardest one. Keep making it simpler. I have my own minimalist tendencies, and in a way, I think it's important to try and make these practices as accessible as possible, to make them so that they're to remove the complexity as much as we can as a starting point. And I would say, I often describe that this is one of my, a mission for me is to take what I think is a fairly, robust, complex way of looking at ourselves and the world and making it accessible without sacrificing the depth. That I think it's possible. I tend to be this, optimistic in the possibility of making these practices highly accessible for wide range of people, and keeping their some of the breadth and depth of what they are offering.
Mark, I'd really like now to talk about your work, particularly at the intersection between large organizations, the digitized life that we lead, and this approach to meditation. So the work that you've done with companies like Google, for example, is extensive, and that really manifested itself in the creation of the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. And that is something, again, that you were very heavily involved in the creation of. So can you speak about, A, your work in this space, and particularly the genesis of the Silly Institute?
Yeah. Its genesis was, this goes back, oh, it's interesting time. It's maybe back in like 2006, there was a Google engineer who had this idea of wanting to create some kind of a meditation and mindfulness program inside of Google. And they had the name for the program, which started out as a joke, you know, because Google's a search company. They said, oh, let's call this program Search Inside Yourself. And at the time, I was doing some executive coaching at Google with a few different engineers. And I got a call asking if I wanted to help help create this program. And there were just a few people involved. And it was interesting. The last part of the call was, oh, and by the way, there's no budget for this program. Are you willing to volunteer your time? And I was like, what? There's some disconnect here. This is this Google, this multi-billion dollar company, and there's no budget. Like, sure, I'll be, how can I help? And actually, it was a blast, and I was there with a small team of people, and we were experimenting and innovating with how do you teach such a program in a place like Google, especially, you know, what is it like? There's nothing quite like standing up in front of 50 Google engineers who are super smart and super skeptical, and saying we're going to talk about mindfulness and emotional intelligence. And I learned a lot. I really learned a lot during those years. Because actually, you know, even though I had a you know, many years by then of meditation practice and mindfulness practice, I had very little experience of conveying it in that kind of environment. So I learned a lot from my co-teachers, especially. I was co-teaching with, you know, with Google engineer and with other, and with neuroscientists and Zen teachers. And so little by little, I felt like I was getting quite the education myself during that time. And it was interesting how, little by little, over a period of 2 or 3 years, something happened, and the program became incredibly popular through word of mouth inside of Google. There were these ridiculously long waiting lists of people wanting to get into the program. So it was that also helped. It meant that when someone showed up to be in one of these programs, it was like they won the lottery, which helped. And at some point, it felt really rooted. It started to feel really rooted inside of Google, and the question came up: how can we grow this to make it available not only to more Google employees, but how can we bring this out into the world? And it was in 2012 that that we started a nonprofit called the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, and I was the CEO, and my co-partner Chad Meng Tong, who's an early Google engineer, he was the chairman of the board, and off we went, and we had you know, tremendous. Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny how, you know, it's like, yes, it was an overnight success that it took several years of really hard work and learning and failing and experimenting. But now Search Inside Yourself is one of the I think most successful prominent kind of mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs. I left the organization about 2 years ago, and I'm now especially this new book. I'm very excited about bringing this program that I've created called Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, which combines this combination, I think, of in-depth mindfulness and meditation practice with leadership and science and emotion, and the format of emotional intelligence, I think, is also a strong structure for teaching these practices. So that's a bit of the story and my story combined.
That's a really fascinating story, and I think for my part, I'm very interested in not so much how you would stand up in front of a room full of engineers and talk about ideas that maybe were introduced to them for the first time. That's probably not the difficult part for me. I'm really interested to know how you overcame the resistance that maybe you would have perceived first time round, and in particular, how you would convince a room full of people that are very much at the forefront of a fast-paced digitizing company, how you would convince them of the importance of combining their strong roles professionally with meditation and mindfulness to get the best out of themselves and their jobs?
I think there were a few different pieces. It's a great question. I think one piece was our attitude was, if you're skeptical, bring it on. You don't have to trust what we're saying. Trust your own experience. Try some of these things. See how it feels. That was one attitude that I think was helpful. Two, especially in the early days, we started by presenting the science that was available around mindfulness, and there was just starting to bubble up at that time some really interesting studies. I think just the fact that there were some very prominent scientific minds who were set on what's the connection between mindfulness practice, meditation practice, and brain structure, and as well as behavior and behavioral patterns, that there's a lot of interesting science happening. And then the third piece, I think, that I noticed had a real impact was one of the core explorations that we did in all of our classes early on was to experiment by having people just listen to each other. And I think it was striking to many, many people when they realize, when you experience how rarely you're actually listening. And you're almost trained in a lot of work environments to not listen, but to put forth your ideas and to be right and to be smart. And there was one of the, I remember this Google engineer using the expression, what a relief it was to take off my game face and let down my guard and let down this sense that I need to be smart and just be curious and more open and listen to other people, other ideas. I think this is an underlying power that these kinds of practices have, that this is I think one of the core connections between, well, why is this important in the workplace? Well, more and more, we work as teams. People in the workplace, everything, almost everything we do, sometimes it's in pairs, sometimes it's in small teams, sometimes it's in large teams. But the ability to collaborate, the ability to cultivate real trust and connection, the ability to have healthy conflict and healthy disagreement. And now so many of our workplaces are cross-cultural and across, you know, across the globe. This this skill set has become, I think, more and more needed and important.
One of the key themes that really spoke to me during the book was this idea of deep listening and just how important it was to leadership. Over and above leaders, so being at the top of a hierarchical structure or being at the head of a department or whatever, but actually people who are in leadership roles that actually have to influence other people and assume leadership roles in society. So I wonder if you can just talk to that a little bit more and just the importance of deep listening and exactly what that is and how we would do that.
Yeah, that this word leadership is a little problematic, right? Because again, our minds go often right to this, the role, there's a particular role. And yes, that it's important, that role of whether it's leading or managing, there are some, leaders have quite a lot of influence. But I think we're all, whether we're in that role or not, we all have influence. And in many different ways, you know, and certainly in our family lives and our communities and in our workplaces. And whatever the role is, there is something about cultivating over and over again this ability to listen, this ability to actually hear views that we might not understand, or that we might even disagree with, or that we might find threatening in some way. So this is this, you know, going back to the antidotes to quieting down or calming down the part of us that is more fearful. And even, you know, one of the things that I think is somewhat unique about this book and about the seven practices is that I'm not shy about saying things like it's important to connect to your pain and connect to the pain of others. Like, wait a minute, what does this have to do with leadership and work? And this is going too far. It's like, no, I think not. Like, I think we have a way of pushing away anything that feels uncomfortable. And I think this is, as you're, I think you're kind of getting, you're kind of grasping that listening is that, you know, it's easy just to say, oh, sure, I listen. Of course I'm listening, but like, no, like noticing when we're not listening. When am I not listening? What's hard for me to hear? And then, you know, in a way, listening is a core part of cultivating, you know, greater understanding. So there's listening for feelings, listening between the words, and even listening. You know, I was telling the story the other day of I started a publishing company. One of the first company that I started in my life out of business school was a greeting card and calendar company called Brush Dance, and it was, I still remember the moment. You know, it was, you know, what, 13 years of being CEO and growing this company. I walked into my office one day and there was this voice in me that said, my heart isn't here anymore. And And of course, my first reaction was, no, don't listen to that voice. That would mean change. And, I noticed myself kind of pushing away my discomfort that was coming up with me, some sense of me not being in alignment with what I was doing. Now, there's something potent about listening to the different voices that we have in us, even the ones that cause us to feel uncomfortable, and noticing when we're not in alignment with ourselves.
I think to paraphrase the Google engineer that you're speaking about, we certainly are nervous apes looking around for threats wherever they may manifest themselves, particularly in the workplace. So because of that, it is so hard to take off our game faces. It is so hard to get to the levels, I guess, of vulnerability that you were speaking about. So I'm really interested to know, in these types of organizations in which many people work, how do you do that deep listening in such a way that it benefits not only your own performance, but the performance of the team and the business, particularly when we are overtly and covertly pushed to compete, achieve, succeed? And to do that, we do need to have that ego. We do need to have that game face on.
In some way, there's a lot of ways that we could talk about. We haven't really talked much about like the practice of meditation, which, again, there's many different ways that I could describe it, and I think one is that you could talk about it as cultivating the ability to listen. That it is, kind of starting with calming the mind enough, noticing the how busy our minds tend to be. Notice how much we tend to get caught in our own thinking, the stories and beliefs and assumptions that we make based on these thoughts that are arising, these feelings and emotions that are arising. So just having a practice where we can step outside of the game, of all the games, and just be present for the full experience of body, mind, thoughts, feelings, and to cultivate that in a way, it's the cultivating the quality of being able to listen to ourselves more fully, starting with, where do my beliefs and assumptions come from? When I'm feeling sad, when I'm feeling happy, when I'm feeling like I belong, when I feel like I don't belong, how can I feel more at home and comfortable with my full experience, and which then allows me to connect with the people I work with and the people I live with in a more grounded and fuller way. And it's interesting, again, our thinking of our language and thinking tends to be very dualistic, right? So do we have our game face on, or do we have our game face off? Well, it's not so black. Maybe it's not black and white, Maybe I have my game face on in that I'm working with a sense of urgency. I'm working with a sense of focus. I'm really trying to achieve things. I'm aware that outcomes matter, results matter, and I care. I care about you as a human being. I notice this tension, in a Zen monastery kitchen. you know, like, oh, we're practicing, you know, we're practicing here, you know, we're being kind to each other, and it's a practice around service. But hey, you know, those carrots, those need to get cut, and we need them cut really well. They need to look exactly like this, and they need to be done by this time, because, you know, we got to start making lunch. You know, so there is this sense of there's always some innate, I think, healthy tension between the environment of caring about each other and the need to get stuff done, and the need to get results.
Absolutely, and certainly I can attest to that tension that exists when we do want to go deeper into our practice and to bring these insights to work and to apply them. But at the same time, when you have deadlines, when you have clients you have to work with, that tension really, really does exist, and it makes it increasingly difficult to apply those. But I'm really interested to know, Mark, for people that are working within organizations who may be embodying this leadership, i.e. being the first person to bring these insights to the workplace and to apply them, what counsel would you give to them? What's the correct way in doing this to ensure that there is a successful application of the insights that you're talking about in the book?
Well, I think this is where there can be some advantages to leadership role, right? So, you know, when I was as the CEO of whether it was my company Brushdance, or more recently the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, I was very intentional about the kind of culture that I wanted to create, and I was very intentional. Even about, and again, there's always some tension about, I wanted to hire people who had the highest level of skill, the skill set for the job that they had. And at the same time, I wanted to bring in people that also had a higher level as possible of self-awareness and emotional intelligence, or at least, and were wanted to cultivate that as part of their work life. That at least saw that could be a core part of what we were doing together. So yes, when we're when we have that kind of power around role, that's one. But it can be harder. And I think maybe the question that you're asking is, Wendy, what if we're not? What if we don't have that kind of role, status. It's interesting, though. I think we can all do it in our, whether it's in our one-to-one meetings with other people or in other meetings. Partly, I think that there's a part of it that I think takes some real skill. There's a skillful means to be able to find just the right way of being more curious and open, being curious and open about what is motivating other people, and asking people about their stories, and just kind of creating a bit more of that connection. I noticed, I did a training recently for a group of 60, these were leaders in a big kind of health insurance company, and there was just such hunger to connect with each other on a more human level. That what happens is we get into a pattern of only connecting about our roles, and of course, we're there. As I said, there's that healthy tension because there is stuff to get done. But I think what people find that what actually can get more stuff done, the more there is understanding, the more there is a kind of trust and curiosity. Again, it's not that we're not turning our work environments into therapy sessions. This is not why we're there. But I think we've gone too far, and we tend to feel like it's not okay to have that more human element around connecting and caring about other people. And so it's just kind of skillfully bringing that in that sense of again listening and understanding in many different situations.
And I think that's a really important point that you just mentioned there, that you know, like about bringing in the human dimension into work. And I wonder if you could just talk to the value of that, because there might be some people listening, or people listening who would know other people who would think that, well, actually the real value is in efficiency. It's in getting things done quicker. And to that point, I will, you know, it's better to kind of bring in software or to have people work longer hours to get these things done. But from what you're saying, of course, that's important to a degree, but the human connection and that human dimension of bringing that into work through these practices has equal, if not greater, value.
Yeah, I noticed my mind going from, you know, we're talking about this kind of, you know, micro level of you know, relationships, but then there's also the macro level, you know. And I think it's similar dynamic, you know, that we've created, you know, as an example, a food manufacturing system, not only in the United States but pretty much worldwide, incredibly efficient at, but what. Efficiency, when you take it to its extreme, it leaves out, wait a minute, how nourishing is this food that we're now manufacturing? We've really emphasized efficiency, and there's, you know, we've created this food system, you know, that can feed, you know, billions of people. But where's the nourishment? What happened to the nourishment of the food that we're supposedly creating? And I think it's a similar, you know, I think in the workplace, the model was this kind of assembly line model. If you look at org charts and you look at the cubicles, work over the past, you know, 50 or 100 years has all been about efficiency and taking the human element out of it, because the human element is so messy. These humans are so messy. And I think there's now a swing back, partly because of technology, and also I think people are experiencing at many different levels the need for stepping back and looking at what is it we're really trying to achieve here, and that. Trying to achieve efficiency at the expense of, like, I think this analogy that I brought up around the food system, I think applies to many of our systems that we're creating. You know, what does it mean to create healthy environments and healthy business cultures? How can we create a healthier planet? You know, why are we, you know, we have these very efficient uses of energy and transportation and all these systems that are brilliant, but they have, we're just now, I think, really seeing the downside and the damage that we've caused to the physical environment and also you know, the statistics about our human environment in terms of from mental illness and the level of suicides and places, the statistics in places like Japan of, you know, that they have a word for people that work themselves to death. And I see that quite a bit here, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area and other places where I was really struck when I was working in Tokyo and Hong Kong and going into an office and meeting someone which I thought was after work and met, you know, for an 8 p.m. meeting. And I noticed that everyone on the whole floor was there working. And I asked about it. They're like, no, we're pretty much here till 10 or 11 every night. And that's what we do. I'm like, really? I was like, that sense of efficiency becomes the culture is a problem.
Fabulous. Well, Mark, look, I know that there's so much more that we have to talk about, but is there anything else that we haven't discussed that you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah, I think Lawrence, as a way of ending, I'd like to just rattle off, you know, these seven practices, which are love the work, do the work, don't be an expert, connect to your pain, connect to the pain of others, depend on others, and keep making it simpler. To me, someone asked me the other day, you know, what is mindfulness? And I said, well, I can define it. These seven practices are, I think, one way to talk about what mindfulness practice is. And I think these practices are, I think they're beautiful. I think they're poetic. And I also think they're practical. That I love the tension between the poetic and the practical. Entering them both. Read lots of poetry, and you know, and learn to fix your car. You can reach me, marklesser.net, marklesser.net, and hey, I look forward to continuing this conversation, Lawrence, with you.